Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, time for a classic from the vault. This one originally aired on January 21st, 2021. It was called Funeral for a Bug. I think this was all literally about funerals for bugs. I recall we get into some stuff about the Roman poet Virgil.
Yeah, yeah. And if you know Virgil's there, it's going to be a party. So here we go. Let's have a listen.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today I wanted to start off by talking about a weird legend about the Roman poet Virgil and an insect funeral. Rob, are you ready for some Virgil talk?
Let's do it.
Okay, so Virgil was a poet who lived in the first century BCE during the Augustan period, so early imperial Rome. And you might know him best from his most famous work, the epic poem, The Aeneid, which is about sort of the founding lineage of Rome and the adventures of the Trojan hero Aeneas, who, after the Trojan War, travels from Troy and eventually becomes the ancestor of the Roman people. Virgil is often considered one of the greatest Latin poets, and he was wildly popular during his own lifetime. He received commendations from kings and the wealthy, and you know, everybody thought, like, wow, this guy has just got the juice. And I had Virgil on my mind a lot last year because Rachel and I were rereading Dante's Divine Comedy. And if you'll recall, of course, Virgil is Dante the Pilgrim's guide through hell and purgatory in the Divine Comedy. So the spirit of Virgil, he's been living out the centuries in limbo because though he was a very virtuous man, he's one of the virtuous pagans. He was never baptized as a Christian, so he can't go to heaven. He's got to hang out in this sort of antechamber of hell where everybody sits around sighing because nothing interesting is ever happening to them.
I have to admit that I tend to, when anybody mentions Virgil, that's the first place my mind goes is Dante's Inferno, which is probably not fair. It's like if you were to mention the name of Socrates and someone were to go, oh, yeah, he's in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure from
that's exactly,
1989.
That's exactly where I knew you were going with that, Bill and Ted, yeah. That is pretty good because, well, though it's slightly different because it's not a he's not at all parodied in the Divine Comedy. In fact, true. I would say it's exactly the opposite. In the Divine Comedy, he is
revered. Yeah.
Yes, he's reimagined as this like superhuman wizard. Mm-hmm. For Dante, Virgil is the embodiment of wisdom and reason. So for the intended readers of the Divine Comedy, we're supposed to understand that Virgil is like a 10 out of 10 platinum level cool beast. He is just like this ultimate wizard of knowledge. And about half of the state, you remember how like basically every other time Dante talks in the first two books of the Divine Comedy, it's just to say like, Virgil, you are so right. I would never doubt your wisdom. Tell me more, you know, and it kind of sinks in because I remember when we got to the end of the Purgatorio and Virgil does not get to move on to heaven with Dante. He has to stay behind and Beatrice takes him on from there. We're really mad that Virgil didn't get to go to heaven.
Yeah. No, I mean, so much time is devoted to him. And also so much is stripped away at that point. You know, it's like, it's hard to follow Dante into Paradiso, just because you know that there aren't going to be any demons playing trumpets with their bums or anything. There's not going to be, you know, monsters so much. And Virgil's not going to be there. So it's, you know, it's part three in a series is always tough.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the trilogy is a hard sell to complete with dignity. I think for modern readers, that sense of injustice about Virgil that is interpreted, you know, by the characters in the Inferno as, you know, perfect divine justice, it's the one person version of the dynamic that plays out throughout the whole thing, where as they're going through hell, it just seems like, wow, this is really unfair.
Yeah.
But anyway, long before Virgil was guiding Dante up the mountain of purgatory in his post-mortem shade form, people were telling lots of legends about his life. And one of those legends is that once at his home in Rome, Virgil built a tomb and held an extravagant funeral for a dead fly. Like a fly as in the insect with six legs and wings. This story is very probably untrue, and we'll get to why that is in a bit. But first, I wanted to explore some of the details. And for this, I was reading an article by George Pendle in Cabinet magazine in 2007 called Virgil's Fly. And he describes the legend in the following way. Quote, "Held in the grounds of Virgil's home on Rome's Esquiline Hill, the funeral attracted the great and good of the city. Dirges were sung and tributes read. Virgil's patron, Maecenas, delivered a lengthy and moving eulogy to the departed insect, and Virgil was himself said to have uttered a few of his exquisite verses over the tiny carcass. A tomb had been erected, and the lifeless body of the fly was placed within it to the wails and moans of the professional mourners. So lavish were the commemorations that the cost was estimated at over 800,000 sesterces." So that's the gist. According to this story, Virgil and his close friends spend huge amounts of money and effort to celebrate the life and memory of an insect, concluding with the insect's burial in a marble tomb. Why on earth would this be? Well, the legend itself also contains an answer to this. So to read from Pendle again, quote, "But the reason for the funeral was not due to extravagance, eccentricity, or even emotion. Having defeated Julius Caesar's assassins at the Battle of Philippi, the Second Triumvirate was at that very moment engaged in confiscating the estates of the rich and dividing them among the war veterans returning from the battlefield. Only one exception was given. If the estate held a burial plot, it was not to be touched. By burying his housefly, Virgil saved his house." So here it has transformed into a classic, one of our favorite genres, loophole fiction.
Yes.
You remember when we did the Anthology of Horror segment in October on deals with the devil and about how many of these stories, I think especially later deal with the devil stories, less so in the earlier ones, they're about somebody saving the day by figuring out a loophole that they can exploit to get out of their end of a pact with Satan. And I wonder again, what's so appealing about this kind of plot resolution? It seems like maybe this would be the kind of thing that's especially interesting to people who live in a more litigious kind of culture.
Could be. I can also imagine that if you've ever taken advantage of a loophole, it probably helps out if you demonize the legal authority to some degree if you make them into a devil, because in all these stories, it's the loophole that saves your soul. Whereas I think there are plenty of cases in real life where the loophole might have the opposite effect. You know,
right.
The loophole is the refuge of less savory individuals at times.
Right. Cheaters and scammers with crafty lawyers to help them get out of trouble by exploiting some kind of, you know, loophole in the wording of something.
Yeah.
Isn't that always like, that's always a really frustrating thing when somebody evades the obvious spirit of justice by exploiting the exact wording of something. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I can't help but wonder if there's some connection there, you know? You make your stories about cheating the devil with your loopholes, and then you feel better about the sort of implied devil that you're cheating through your own loophole usage.
Well, it's actually funny. There is, in this Pendle article, he also talks about a medieval legend about Virgil, and we'll get into more of these legends about Virgil's life as we go on, but one of these medieval legends about Virgil is that Virgil frees a demon from there's like a devil trapped in a bottle, and Virgil lets it out so that it will empower him to do something great. I think maybe he uses its powers to get a long road paved or something like that. But anyway, once he has used this demon power, now I think the demon's supposed to get his end of the bargain and is going to do something really bad. But first Virgil's like, wow, you're so powerful. Could you show me again how you fit your frame into that bottle? So the devil does, and then he corks it back up. So he gets to have his magic and keep the genie in the bottle as well.
Oh, that's great. I don't know how to climb into an oven, and I've never sat on a shovel.
So that's some Jack Frost for
us. That's some Jack Frost. That's from some Ivanushka right there.
So in that spirit, there's obviously this interesting process by which after Virgil's death, remember he lived in the first century BCE, in the centuries after his death, his poetry was greatly admired and revered, but not just his poetry. He himself was greatly admired and revered and took on the aspects of a saint in many ways, even though he had been a pagan. There's an interesting note in his cabinet article where Pendle shares this fact that kind of helps make more sense of the almost absurd reverence shown for Virgil in the Divine Comedy. In centuries after his death, many Romans and later Italians in the Middle Ages thought of Virgil as possessing a literally supernatural or near supernatural genius, that there was something magical about his poetry, the same way people would feel there is magic in the holy text of their religion. And one clear illustration of this is that in the second century CE under the Antonines, there had arisen this form of divination. And we've done episodes on divination in the past. You know, there are various ways of trying to sort of turn some sort of noise or random input into an interpreted type of information about hidden knowledge, you know, what's going to happen in the future or some other thing you want to know but can't. Virgil's poetry was itself used for divination. And so people would randomly select passages from the Aeneid and then read those passages as some kind of prediction about their future or statement about some other kind of hidden knowledge. Pendle writes, quote, "It is said that these sortes Virgilianae or Virgilian lots were consulted by both the emperors Hadrian and Severus. And with each consultation, Virgil's memory began to take on an increasingly mystical air." But anyway, to get back to the story about Virgil and the fly. So again, this story is almost certainly not true. There are elements of it that fit within known history. Apparently, Virgil did actually have a house on the Esquiline Hill. The second triumvirate was actually engaged in seizing estates so they could be given to returning veterans from military campaigns. But that's just the accurate stuff about the setting. The main reason the story is probably untrue is simply that there is no contemporary evidence or record of it. Nobody anywhere near Virgil's lifetime mentions anything about it. It only shows up in much, much later sources. Rather, it seems to be one of those legends that accumulates on a, you know, sort of gloms onto a revered historical figure due to a chain of associative thinking. So what's the chain? Well, that brings us to an absurd and absurdly interesting Latin poem called the Culex, which means, I think you can interpret it as like the gnat or the fly. Culex is also a genus name for certain types of mosquitoes. So I think it means like a flying insect. And so this is a poem that was published sometime after Virgil's death, and it was attributed to him as part of his juvenilia. It was widely said, okay, so this is something that Virgil actually wrote, but he wrote it when it was young, and that's why it's maybe not as good as his other poetry. Modern scholars, I think, mostly really doubt that Virgil actually wrote this. It would technically be a poem in the pastoral genre. So that's poetry about the supposedly blissful, uncomplicated life of people in the countryside. It's usually about shepherds or herdsmen, often a lot of references to flowers and naps and clouds and cool waters, the idols of Pan. And it made me think about how, you know, so for hundreds of years, the pastoral poem from the classical period, even into the Renaissance was, well, actually, I'd say even into the Romantic poetry era, there is this tendency to fall back on this classic genre of stuff about the fields and the simple life of shepherds and all that, and how great it is. And I wonder if this is sort of realized in modern culture in our desire for like simple, aesthetically gentle content like the Great British Bake Off. Is that the pastoral poetry of the modern era?
Yeah, perhaps, you know, just sort of like soothing and non-offensive, perhaps, you know, just you know, it's not even really escapism. It's just, I mean, I guess to a certain extent it is escapism, but yeah, perhaps I could see that connection.
I don't know. It connected in my brain. But so there's a plot in this poem, the Culex. It is widely regarded as absolutely ridiculous, but here is how it goes. A shepherd goes out in the morning to take his flocks to pasture, and there's some standard pastoral poetry musing on how the simple life of a shepherd living in the fields is so much better than the fraught life of a rich man, because it's better to throw your body down in the tender grass and lay your head among the flower buds than to be consumed with the grief and the greed that curdles the hearts of the rich and powerful. So the shepherd is living this nice idyllic life. He takes his flock to a fountain in the woods, and there he falls asleep lying in the shade. But while he's asleep, a giant, horrible snake slithers up. It's coming to the fountain where it likes to lie in the mud, and it decides it's going to bite the shepherd in his sleep and kill him. But just before the snake attacks, a gnat buzzes down and stings the shepherd on the eye. And this wakes him up, and the shepherd crushes the gnat, but it also wakes him up just in time to see the snake and to save himself. So he beats the snake to death with a piece of wood, which I would say in reality is almost never necessary. Even if a snake is dangerous, you can run away from it.
Right, but this is a storybook snake, and you know how they do. They do things like wrap around you and tie you to a tree or swallow you whole. So, you know, within the context of the story, maybe it's justified.
Right. So, yeah, he gets this piece of wood, beats the snake into a bloody pulp. And then later, the shepherd goes to sleep again, and the ghost of the gnat appears. It comes to him in a dream, and the gnat chews him out for not being grateful. He's like, "Why'd you crush me? I saved your life." And the shepherd wakes up, and he feels remorse for what he's done, and he builds a tomb in honor of the gnat, and then decorates the tomb with flowers and fruit. And so, to read briefly from the tomb section of the poem, it says, "For him at length did heedful care the toil begun completing, gathered up the piled material, and with a plenteous mound of earth a tomb arose in circle shaped. Around it placing stone of marble smooth, he plants it, mindful of his constant care, and growing here throughout the brilliant ring, acanthus is, and bashful roses too, and every kind of violet." And then there are a bunch of lines about flowers. I'm going to skip towards the end of that flower section. "The amaranth is here, and grapes which large do cluster, ever flowering picris too. Narcissus isn't absent there, in whom his beauty's radiance from Cupid's fire, for limbs his own begot a hot desire, and all the flowers that blooming seasons know. With these the mound is planted o'er, then on the front is placed the inscription, which asserts, the letters saying it with silent speech, O tiny gnat, the keeper of the flocks, doth pay to thee. deserving such a thing, the duty of a ceremonial tomb in payment for the gift of life to him.
All right. Well, there you have it. A poem about honoring the gnat that saved him from the snake when he was sleeping on the job.
This is something I'm actually confused about. Are shepherds supposed to just sleep while they're watching their flocks? Or are they not supposed to be watching?
I don't know, but you do. It is part of that pastoral sort of image, you know. Mm-hmm. Like we've all encountered some version of that before. Which I'm guessing most of that is just it's pining for this presumed idyllic lifestyle in the country, where it's like, oh, you're just looking after sheep. It's just like a nap all day. That's all, just all it is.
Right.
Glossing over all the other stuff that comes,
all the hard
with
work,
being a shepherd. Yeah.
But anyway, once again, it seems that modern scholars do not accept that Virgil actually wrote this poem. Virgil did write pastoral poetry. For example, in his eclogues, there's this great part in the 10th eclogue where he concludes with a wonderful passage to cite at bedtime, where he writes, "Come, let us rise. The shade is wont to be baneful to singers. Baneful is the shade cast by the juniper. Crops sicken, too, in the shade. Now homeward, having fed your fill, Eve's star is rising. Go, my she-goats, go."
Okay, I guess that's pretty good. But yeah, if you were just going off of this passage, I don't know if you'd really buy Dante's hype for Virgil.
Well, I mean,
the she-goats part is nice.
That is the good part. And it is in translation. I think, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, for every type of poetry in translation, there's a lot of stuff that's lost. Yeah. But anyway, so the Culex, there's a good chance it was written by someone else and then published under Virgil's name. And it may well have had some kind of other meaning, like a veiled meaning as a political allegory, though I didn't follow the threads on that. But despite the doubt about the authorship, the poem seems to have given rise to all kinds of bizarre fly legends associated with Virgil. So to read a segment from Pendle, I thought this was amazing. Quote, "One of the most popular Neapolitan myths held that Virgil had created a bronze fly the size of a frog and placed it on one of the gates of Naples. The talisman remained there for 8 years, during which time no flies could enter the city. In a similar vein, armies attacking Naples were said to have been harassed by swarms of flies sent after them by the poet. The fly would become Virgil's magical familiar over the ensuing years, never far from any tale of his exploits. And that was not all. Possibly due to this control of pestilence, Virgil was said to have created baths that cured all illnesses and a butcher's block on which meat stayed fresh for 6 weeks. No longer renowned as the master of grammar and philosophy, Virgil's achievements were put down to his mathematical knowledge. In only a few centuries, Virgil had gone from being the preeminent poet of the Roman Empire to a Neapolitan enchanter with a penchant for magical insects." And there's all kinds of fabulous stuff about medieval legends about Virgil becoming more of a necromancer type figure, that he's got all these strange magical powers like that, you know, that he commands the insects of the air and casts them down upon his enemies or can save you from them. And I love that I don't know if there was anything in his actual life to associate him with flies. It's only this poem that he probably didn't even actually write and isn't actually very good that was attributed to him later that gave rise to all these strange stories.
Wow, that's something. Yeah, I don't recall, you know, picking up on the idea of the wizard Virgil, but now I'm fascinated by it.
Well, I think one thing is, by the Middle Ages, he had these broadly understood wizard associations, but I think Dante was sort of moving back against that and saying, like, no, let's fit him more into the Christian cosmology and say that he's more this beacon of reason and wisdom in the pagan world.
But we do see this wizardization taking more hold with other figures, like Roger Bacon comes to mind. And we've talked about this on the show before.
Oh, yeah. I remember in one of our previous episodes, we sort of concluded that maybe one of the greatest contributions of Roger Bacon as a you know, man of great learning in the Middle Ages in the 13th century was that he was very open to sources of knowledge from all over the world. So a lot of what he did was say, like, apply things that he learned from texts from the medieval Muslim world, like the texts of Ibn al-Haytham and other things, or like studying objects brought to him from countries afar. So he was sort of a good collector of knowledge from many places, but somehow gets this, gets this label affixed to him like he's some kind of wonder worker, which he wasn't really in life.
Right. I mean, he was, it seems like he was a very impressive individual, but yeah, he instantly becomes elevated to like arch alchemist status in some of these tellings. You know, he takes on all the guise of some sort of a mad scientist in a serial adventure. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
The main reason I think I was originally inspired to look into this topic and do this episode about insects and funerals was when I read an interesting article on Atlas Obscura that was also by George Pendle, the same writer as that Cabinet Magazine article about Virgil and the Fly. And this article is on the broader topic of insects and funerary rites.
Yeah, this was a good article by Pendle, the Fly Master here. he touches on numerous associations between insects and death. Particularly, the author points out, quote, necklaces of stone-carved flies to ward off maggots worn by the ancient Egyptian dead. The idea being here that the maggots were seen as a threat to one's ka or ba, you know, the vital essences in the body, mm-hmm. In the individual. And I found this interesting. So the first thing I did was I looked up to see if Gene Kritsky had written on this. Gene Kritsky, of course, is a former guest on the show. He wrote a book called The Tears of Ray about the ancient Egyptian use of bees and honey and how they treated bees and honey, both in terms of just creating products as well as magical uses, etc.
I was thinking about that episode and about Gene Kritsky when I was recording a recent episode of The Artifact I did, which was about ancient Egyptian head cones. Mm-hmm. If you haven't listened to that artifact yet, I thought it was a lot of fun, so maybe you should check it out. But the short version is there are these white cones depicted on top of people's heads in a lot of ancient Egyptian art, but nobody had ever found any physical evidence that they existed in reality. So there's been this debate about what were these cones? Did they ever actually exist in the world? Or are they some kind of artistic convention? And and in recent years, there has been an excavation that uncovered physical examples of these head cones for the first time at a couple of graves in Amarna in Egypt. But unlike some of the theories in which these cones were made of like perfumed animal fat, these cones were made out of biological wax, which I knew immediately when I read that, oh, that's got to be beeswax because of the role of beeswax in ancient Egyptian culture. And sure enough, that seems like what they almost definitely were made of.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, we've covered a few different Egyptian topics in the artifact. So so definitely check those out. I'm sure we'll do more. But in this case, I turned to Gene Kritsky's work. And particularly, I looked at a book that he wrote with an author by the name of Ron Cherry titled Insect Mythology. Mm. And so they get into this a bit. They point out that in ancient Egypt, the fly, first of all, it was also a symbol of valor. Because what does a pesky fly do? Well, it'll move in, it'll bite you, try to bite you. You drive it away by swatting your hand around. But then what does it do? It comes back. It's persistent, and therefore it is a symbol of valor.
Wow, I've never thought of that before. But yeah, when the fly comes in to sting at you, it's like a human going up against a dragon or a giant.
Yeah. And so we have this this one example in particular where Queen Ahotep gave her sons, three of her sons, golden flies to honor their fights against an adversary. So I thought that was interesting. And you can actually look up examples of this because I believe the idea is these three flies were then buried with her and then were part of the treasures that were unearthed with her body. And yeah, they're these beautiful golden fly ornaments, but they stand for valor. Now, as for the funeral necklace, yes, this seems accurate as well. So in the Egyptian climate, flies would take to the dead rather quickly, and freshly hatched flies would be seen leaving the body before embalming could be completely finished. These flies were seen as, again, the individual's ka or ba leaving the body. So the fly necklaces were a way to essentially put flies back on the body, to return this leaked ka to the deceased.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So this is really interesting as well. The ka or ba is sometimes represented as a bird with a human head, but you also see versions of it that consist of a fly with a human head.
Oh.
And so the authors here, Kritsky and Cherry, they point out that there is at least at the time this was written, which I want to say was a couple of decades ago. At the time, and I imagine still to this day, there is this surviving folk belief that certain varieties of flies with a greenish or bluish metallic body were not to be killed, as these contained or were likely to contain the spirit of someone who had died. So, and then they say this would just be one of many modern beliefs that are seemingly tied to the traditions and beliefs from the age of the pharaohs.
But the idea of a fly with a human head certainly also makes me think of some 20th century cinematic literature.
Yeah, yeah. It brings to mind the 1958 movie The Fly, which ends with that that scene with the help me scene with the fly with the human head.
Which we had to stand corrected on. That is not Vincent Price, whose head is on that fly.
Vincent Price, different actor.
Yeah, he plays like his brother or something.
Yeah. But yeah, so it brings to mind a modern monster movie. But it's also interesting because on a physical level, this is correct. There is something of the departed's body, anyway, in the substance of the emergent fly.
Ooh,
there is a connection to be made.
Yeah, the chemical energy from... Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So again, the idea is not so much to keep flies away, but it's like to return what has leaked out to the body through symbolic flies. Now, as for flies in general, Kritsky and Cherry point out that flies are often associated with death just throughout global myth cycles. And they roll through a number of examples in their book. You have like the Greek daemon of decomposition, Uranomos, and this was depicted often as either a vulture or a fly, a consumer of carrion.
Mm-hmm.
Other fly demons can be found as well, such as, of course, Beelzebub, at least in his demonic interpretations later. He was originally a Syrian god. You have the Yazads and Nasu of Zoroastrianism. And Nasu, they describe as, quote, the demoness of dead matter.
Mm.
And flies were also a symbol of torment for early European Christians. The god Loki was said to have taken on the form of a fly in order to pass through a keyhole. And this transformation, the transformation of one's body into that of a fly, this has also been associated with witches, they write, in Hungarian traditions. However, in all this, they point out two outstanding exceptions to the negative roles of mythological flies. And they're pretty interesting because these kind of take me back to what you shared from that poem that has been attributed to Virgil. So the first example is Big Biter. Big Biter is an overlord of fish in what I believe is currently known as the Innu tribe of, and this is a Canadian First Nations people.
Mm-hmm.
And this spirit would have taken the form of a fly. And Kritsky and Cherry write that he, quote, hovered over the fishermen in order to see how his subjects were being treated. Occasionally, an overlord would bite the fishermen to remind him that the fish were in his custody and to warn against wastefulness.
Whoa.
So I like that, the idea of – I also – it just kind of feels like it's kind of – illustrates the universal experience of fishing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're perhaps going to gaze off into space. You're going to be bit by insects,
mm-hmm.
And then maybe have to confront the possibility of wastefulness. But anyway, another one is Big Fly, and this one is in the Navajo religion, and it is a mentor or helper that mediates between humans and the gods. And so it'll frequently show up in stories and appear to a hero and tell them how to proceed. And so that's the example that reminds me specifically of what we see in that poem attributed to Virgil.
Yes, not just as a helper who intervenes to save his life, but one who later appears to teach him a lesson.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one thing, of course, that they drive home in this book is that it's worth remembering that other insects had entirely different roles in ancient Egyptian traditions. The scarab beetle, for instance, symbolizes perpetual life and renewal. Khepri is, in fact, the dawn manifestation of Ra or Re, the sun god, and this is derived from Kheper, which meant to become or to be transformed. And so the reason for this is twofold, according to Geraldine Pinch in the book Egyptian Mythology. First, dung beetles rolling spheres of dung were compared to the movement of the sun across the sky, something that would be carried by the gods in the sky barge. And secondly, the sight of young beetles emerging from buried dung balls, this raised ideas of self-generation. And so these acts of transformation would have applied to more than just birth and death, but also to the various rites of passage in one's life. So not just being born, not just dying, but also, growing up, changing who you are, this sort of perpetual act of emerging and becoming.
Oh, I like this because I think it's something I've seen from Egyptologists in recent years who sometimes emphasize that older schools of Egyptology would sometimes overemphasize the prevalence of thinking about death and the afterlife in ancient Egyptian culture, and that this might just be a result of the bias in what types of artifacts are preserved for us to look at to get a sense of their culture. And so yeah, I like the idea of like seeing how it has a lot to do with birth and life itself as well.
Yeah. This is a theme that I actually just touched on in one of the artifact episodes, having to deal with the Cairo toe. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if this has come out yet by the time this episode publishes, but at any rate, it has to do with an element, an artifact that could certainly be interpreted as something that is just about the dead, but upon closer examination is far more about the living and the experience of living people.
Yeah. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, even though it is fascinating to know all these things about ancient Egyptian funerary rituals and their beliefs about death and the afterlife. You can easily get this mistaken assumption that, like, in ancient Egypt, all anyone did was die and be entombed and think about death. And obviously that can't be true.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they were human beings, and they were subject to all the other whims and obsessions of human life. Now, in terms of their other relationships with insects and arachnids, scorpions, for instance, arachnids were considered just enemies of humanity. But they were also associated with the goddess Serket, who protected the body of the deceased, as well as the canopic jars that would contain organs. But to come back to that Atlas Obscura article by George Pendle, they write that there's a particular civilization of northern Peru, the Mochi or the Mochica. This would have been a civilization pre-Columbian, of course, but also pre-Incan that ran from around 100 to 750 CE. And they seemingly practiced some manner of sky burial, in which the flies that lighted upon the dead and then emerged from the dead were interpreted as an essential part of the spirit's journey.
Maybe much like carrion birds would be in some other types of sky burial type traditions.
Yeah, that was where my mind instantly went to, like, the Tibetan model of where a body is sort of processed for carrion birds in an elevated rocky area where other modes of burial are not as much of an option. Mm-hmm. And this would be a way of, like, returning the body to the world, to the element, through scavengers, through carrion consumers. So I decided to look into this a little bit more because this was instantly fascinating as well. You know, I have this example that turns things on its head a bit. There's a 2010 study I was reading published in the Journal of Archaeological Science by Hutchett and Greenberg. And a lot of this theory depends on the post-mortem interval in remains, how long the bodies of these peoples were exposed prior to burial. Hmm. And that's one of the keys there is that it's not simply I'll get into this here, but like it's not just like, okay, then they left the bodies out. No, this would have been part of a more protracted funeral rite.
I see.
So the Mochi, they excelled in ceramics. They practiced human sacrifice. And to be clear, a lot of ancient cultures did, not to sweep human sacrifice under the rug or anything. But I think, as we've touched on before, I think it pays to be fair in looking at particular cultures and regions that are often highlighted for this sort of thing, that we have to sort of keep in mind that plenty of other ancient cultures also did human sacrifice as well. And they were no exception. But they apparently had a complex religious system with complex mortuary practices supported by evidence of delayed burials, grave reopenings, and secondary offerings of human remains. Their ceramic illustrations reveal a lot about the role of flies in their beliefs. With there are these motifs of flies following prisoners to execution in anticipation of their corpses, as well as oval-shaped motifs that may represent flies emerging from the puparia. So, it's really interesting to think about this. This would have been a society where instead of sort of taking the Egyptian route and saying, well, the flies are part of the soul leaving the body, and we have this magical symbolism that will prevent that or reverse the leakage. This is like a celebration of it. It would seem that's the argument anyway, that they seem to have incorporated it into their understanding of what our bodies and and or perhaps our souls do when we die, you know, that it's that the flies moving in and then out of our bodies is just a part of what is supposed to happen. It's part of the sacrament.
Though it's very interesting to see cultures in which that that sort of biological knowledge about what happens to a human body that's left exposed to the surface elements gets incorporated into religious beliefs, as opposed to the idea that a body should be, you know, immediately buried, hidden away to a different place where you cannot see nature acting upon it as it decomposes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially modern culture, we're so far removed from physical death, you know, that and I think some would argue that we're too far removed from it, you know, that it it makes it more problematic in some cases when it does occur, and it of course will occur, and it does impact our lives. It's interesting to try and envision how a culture like this would have handled death, because again, it would have been, according to the way they were discussing it in this article, it would have been a situation where, like, the body dies, there's some sort of ritual that is conducted, but the body is left out and long enough for the flies to begin to work upon it, and then other funeral customs come into play, and then it is eventually buried, and then there may be a phase later on where the tomb is reopened. So it's you know, there's a lot more in and out compared to what we're more accustomed to with our modern funeral rites.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, so we've been talking about legends of human funerals for insects. We've been talking about associations between insects, especially flies, and human funerary rituals in different cultures. But one other thing that I thought would be good to talk about would be how insects deal with their own dead, the funerals within the insect world. Mm-hmm. And one place I was looking was that there's a good short article on Nat Geo from 2017 by Allie Wilkinson that collects some really interesting examples of scientific studies and observations about how different types of social insects in particular treat their own dead within and around their nest. And I think if you're looking for the really interesting practices, I think it would be these are especially going to be among social insects. So the article is called Queen Ants and Other Insects Bury Their Dead, Here's Why. And so just to look at a couple of examples cited here, and maybe we can come back and talk more about the general theory on why some of these things happen. For example, among ants, it is commonly observed that in mature ant colonies, there's a very orderly process for removing dead ants from the nest. Worker ants will locate dead individuals from the colony and then systematically carry their bodies away, either to a place away from the nest, like a trash heap that's removed from the main nest activity, or to a special chamber within the nest. And Wilkinson also points out a cool study from the journal BMC Evolutionary Biology from 2017 by Christopher Pull and Sylvia Kramer, reporting that under some conditions, in some ants, even queens will engage in undertaker duties. We can come back to why that is a bit more later on, but just to explore what happens, in the example of the black garden ant, sometimes in a young colony where there aren't many workers yet, if one of the early queens in the colony dies, the surviving queen will go to the dead queen's body, bite it up into a bunch of pieces, and then bury those pieces herself. Which kind of goes against the idea of, you know, the queen ant or the queen bee, you know, the queen in a social insect species just being like, you know, sitting around and doing nothing and letting the workers do all the work and basically only existing to fulfill reproductive duties and never having any toil to their own.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, you tend not to think about this. You either go overboard and associate all sorts of like human qualities with the ant ruler, or you do just think of them fulfilling this one key job within the colony.
Though to be clear, I think biologically that is the most important job of theirs, and most of the work of the colony is relegated to these non-reproducing workers.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, just because you're reproducing all the time doesn't mean you can't clean up a little bit, right?
Right. So another example, bee colonies. In bees, there appears to be a very well-organized behavior system for quickly ejecting dead bodies from the nest. Looks like they usually just get dropped on the ground outside the nest. And in honeybees, this disposal process tends to happen very fast. It's carried out by a special class of middle-aged worker bees representing about 1% to 2% of the population of the nest. And Wilkinson points to a 1983 study by P. Kirk Vischer in the journal Animal Behavior that found really acute time sensitivity in how the bees prioritize body disposal. So, for example, corpses that were 1 hour old were removed faster than bees that had died just moments before. And I think this probably relies on some kind of chemical signal, you know, something you can smell coming off of the dead bee. Because Vischer notes also that dead bees that were coated in paraffin, which would probably interfere with the penetration of smells and stuff, are removed much more slowly. And then one last thing, in termites, Wilkinson also writes about some interesting behavior in termites, whereas bees and ants tend to remove the dead bodies from the nest or deposit them in a special trash chamber, termites often bury their dead within the nest. But I guess that gets us to the question of why. Like, why would insects have these organized, efficient funerary practices for the disposal of the dead within their colonies? And I think there's a pretty clear answer to it, at least a pretty clear primary answer, and that is disease control.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I was reading a very concise article about this by the authors Sun and Zhao. This was Corpse Management and Social Insects from 2013 in the International Journal of Biological Sciences. And they summed it up as follows. Undertaking behavior is an essential adaptation to social life that is critical for colony hygiene in enclosed nests. Social insects dispose of dead individuals in various fashions to prevent further contact between corpses and living members in a colony. And I think that that kind of puts a nice little tight bow on it right there. That's kind of the concise answer. But of course, it gets a lot more complicated than that. And certainly when you get into the various specific examples. Again, I think it's important to note to note all this, because one of the major realities of modern funeral practices is that we often have an almost extreme separation from physical death. Again, some would argue it's even detrimental separation from physical death. But this is, in fact, one of the key factors in having funeral rites and practices, to limit the amount of contact between the living and the dead. Not just because the dead can be unsightly and troubling for the living to behold, not only to prop up some notion of continuation of the individual after death, but also because the dead are unhygienic and can serve as disease vectors. Now, with solitary animals, that's one thing, right? Avoidance is usually the best approach if you encounter one of your own dead. But social animals are just going to regularly encounter their own dead. There are essentially three different ways of dealing with your own dead when you encounter them. There's necrophagy, eating the dead. There's corpse removal, and there's burial. And necrophagy, as we've discussed in the show before, is pretty widespread in various organisms, and is also found in human traditions. It's one solution, though it's of course not without its own complications.
Mm-hmm.
But as Sun and Zhao point out, while sanitary issues related to corpses are widespread, they are particularly sharp in dense populations for social organisms. And of course, that category certainly includes human beings, but it also includes eusocial insects like bees, ants, and termites. And so we see complex responses at the individual and colony level to deal with the dead, to engage in what humans would call undertaking. So they point out that for certain social spiders and social aphids, corpse removal is just an indistinguishable part of clearing out a nest site. It's, quote, indistinguishable from dealing with inanimate nest waste. So that's one way of approaching it.
It's just like if you would get like a twig or something in your nest area and you'd clean that out eventually. The same thing happens to the dead aphid.
Right. It would be kind of like if you were, if you had a human house and you were to remove a dead body from your house with about as much precaution and ceremony as you would take out the trash, mm-hmm. where you're like, oh, well, they're dead, so I'll take them out and put them in the trash can. That's kind of what some of these social spiders and social aphids are doing. But they point out that in ants, bees, wasps, termites, we see much more complex modes of behavior in which the treatment of the dead is distinct from the treatment of other waste products. And these methods kind of pick from the eat, remove, bury toolbox of possibilities. And I think we see that in some of these specific answers that you already looked at. You know, the idea of, say, cutting up the body of the dead and then burying those pieces, of just simply removing the dead and just throwing them out of the colony versus removing them and burying them, or in the case of the termites, just burying them within the nest.
One of the really interesting questions, I guess, here is among these eusocial insects, how do they know what to do? You know, like how do they know how to guide and control this behavior? What's the nervous system flow chart for an ant or a bee to participate in undertaking?
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting. And you get into a lot of really deep research over the years, because what is the trigger that causes them to remove the dead? And by the way, there's a term for this, for the removal of the dead, and it is necrophoresis. And this is from the Greek, just basically to remove the dead. But it was coined by none other than E.O. Wilson.
Oh, okay.
The master ant researcher who this was one of his research projects for a while, was like looking at how individual ants within a colony pick up on death and then respond accordingly. So, you know, obviously this is the first step. You have to know what's dead. Is this a live ant or is this a dead ant? Is it getting better? Is it just a flesh wound? Whatever. You know, you have to be able to react accordingly. You know, it's vital to colony health, and it's based on chemical signals, apparently, as is much of the activity within the ant world. And you can broadly think of the behavior as entailing death recognition, and then behavioral responses, and then task allocation for dealing with the dead. So Wilson and his fellow researchers identified what they called fatty acid death cues as being important here, though subsequent research seems to suggest that those are not the only signals involved, because sometimes the response time seems too short, like the ants in question are reacting before the fatty acid death cues would generate. It all gets very, you know, complicated in ant world chemical. Mm-hmm. But basically, they seem to lean more into perhaps a chemical vital sign detection by the ants. So it's not just picking up maybe on one chemical that's saying I'm dead, but it's more of like a chemical vital sign array that an ant is able to pick up on and read. And in this particular Sun and Zhao article, they also write that the term necromone is also used. This is like pheromone, except related to death. And this has been used to describe sort of the realm of death recognition chemicals. Mm-hmm. I love that the necromone. It sounds like something that would be made up for a Riddick film, you know?
Yes.
But also fits well within the ant world, you know, that they would, again, the chemical language of them. I love this idea of these, you know, these creatures that we often, you know, we think about them as being very simple. And they are, you know, in a way, like simple but complex parts of this greater whole. And there's this whole language that they're engaged in, this chemical language that it's kind of a stretch for us to truly imagine it. You know, the imagine being able to read the chemical vital signs of other members of our society.
That is really interesting. And weirdly, like it gets even deeper, because there are some of these behaviors for the eusocial insects removing the dead from their nests that incorporate prioritization of the task based on how much of a disease risk the dead body would actually entail. Mm-hmm. So that raises all these other questions, like how can they tell what kind of disease risk this is? Like that, there's a section in that Wilkinson article that talks about a 2013 study in the journal Scientific Reports about termites that found that the termites would react differently to a dead body within their nest, depending on whether it was a member of their own species or from a very closely related species. Just to read from Wilkinson, quote, "Regardless of whether a corpse of the same species came from their own colony or another colony, it was pulled back into the holding chamber for nutrient recycling and hygienic purposes. But if the corpse was that of a dark southeastern subterranean termite, or Reticulotermes virginicus, it was entombed by workers on site with a large group of soldiers standing guard. 10 times as many termites were involved with the burial of this closely related species than the same species. But the extra time, energy, and labor were warranted, researchers found, in the face of external pathogens." So there seems to be some kind of like evolutionary mechanism controlling the behavior here that recognizes certain types of dead termites within the nest as an elevated disease risk, because maybe they're bringing in a pathogen that is new to the nest and could decimate it if it's not disposed of, you know, immediately and totally, even though that might be a very energy intensive process for the colony.
Yeah, it's amazing how these, you know, each colony is like this entire immune system.
Mm-hmm. And that brings me back to that other study I was talking about earlier, the one in BMC Evolutionary Biology about the black garden ant and how the queens mm-hmm. will sometimes participate in undertaking behaviors if the colony is young and there are not enough workers to help out with it. And this is a situation where there can be multiple co-founding queens in a colony. Actually, just to read from the abstract of the study, quote, "Social insects form densely crowded societies in environments with high pathogen loads, but have evolved collective defenses that mitigate the impact of disease. However, colony-founding queens lack this protection and suffer high rates of mortality. The impact of pathogens may be exacerbated in species where queens found colonies together, as healthy individuals may contract pathogens from infectious co-founders. Therefore, we tested whether ant queens avoid founding colonies with pathogen-exposed conspecifics and how they might limit disease transmission from infected individuals. And what this found is when there were these co-founders, these co-founding queens in a colony, if one of the original queens died, the surviving queen again would do this biting process where they would sort of chomp up the other queen into pieces and then bury and remove the corpse. And the authors here write, quote, "These undertaking behaviors were performed prophylactically, i.e. targeted equally towards non-infected and infected corpses, as well as carried out before infected corpses became infectious. Biting and burial reduced the risk of queens contracting and dying from disease from an infectious corpse of a dead co-foundress." So they did actually find this had a survival benefit to the queen that's doing this work, because better to be safe than sorry and get that corpse buried just in case it could become infectious.
Well, this has been interesting. I think by looking at insects and their relationship to death, we've kind of gotten to explore both ends of the spectrum, like the stripped down version of what funeral rites are, like what does it mean to bury the departed and why do we do it on a very basic level, but then also seeing how some of these insects end up being brought into far more elaborate understandings of human death as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, we could and probably should come back in the future and talk more about funeral traditions. We've talked about funeral traditions on the show before, but yeah, we could come back and discuss sort of like the early days, like how what are some of the earliest examples of burial among humans and prehumans, and what does it mean? Like what aspects of it do we still see in our practices today?
Yeah, those types of things are often interpreted as the earliest signs we have of the development of religion in humans. But, you know, that's a really interesting area with a lot of questions open.
Yeah. On the ant front, obviously, we've done plenty of other ant episodes that I'd refer folks back to, including our three-parter on ant warfare that we did earlier this year. But I also want to mention a really great YouTube channel. This is one called Ants Canada. Are you familiar with this one, Joe?
I don't think so.
I was not familiar with it until a friend recommended it as something to show kids. And it's also really interesting for adults as well. But this individual has this entire channel devoted to their various ant farms and also habitats for other creatures, but ants are the key focus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really well done. Lots of great photography and video work. Some of the very topics we've discussed here pop up in the show as they chronicle the ins and outs of the various ant colonies and how they deal with their dead, how they deal with invaders and stuff of that nature. So my family's really been enjoying it. So if you have any ant fans out there, I highly recommend it. It's good stuff.
Oh, I just looked this channel up. I see one title on a popular video here seems to take a page from E.O. Wilson. Says, "Fire Ants Versus My Hand."
Yep. I think E.O. Wilson would approve.
But here's another one. "Cockroach Giving Birth While Being Devoured by Fire Ants." Well, yeah, I'll have to give this a shot.
Yeah, I think some of these popular ones maybe look – they make the channel look a little grislier than it actually is.
Of course.
I'm sure – I don't know if I've watched any of these top ones yet. I kind of come in and out of the room while it's on sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I inevitably end up pausing to see what's going on. There'll be some big mystery
right. With
the colony. And, they explore and they watch and they figure it out.
Of course, whatever is the grossest and most gruesome content on the channel is going to be the most viewed.
Well, yeah, that's what will be rewarded. But, you know, the ants don't care. They don't care about clicks and subscribers. All right, we're going to go ahead and close it out there. If you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you should check out the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast channel. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. Core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Weird House Cinema on Fridays, And we got Artifact and Listener Mail in the mix as well. And wherever you listen to the show, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.